the halving has gone along with these four-year cycles, but the problem is we don't know if it's the supply side, the halving driving these price gains, or if it's the demand or liquidity side driving it. These halvings have also coincided with liquidity cycles, which it may do again. So we don't have a counterfactual yet to compare these against. We just look at those long-term fundamentals I mentioned before. Is the network growing? Are people still transacting on it? Basically, this is for someone who's maybe sold on the investment thesis, they want a core position, they're DCAing into it, and they just want to make sure that that thesis is intact. And that currently is still intact as well for both Bitcoin and Ether.
Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by Mantra, the security first, compliance focused L1, which is onboarding the next wave of financial institutions. You're going to be hearing all about them later in the show, but for now, Mantra, thanks for making this episode possible. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of On the Margin. Today I'm joined by Chris Kuiper, Director of Research at Fidelity Digital Assets. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you. My pleasure. Glad to be here.
I thought we could start off. It's very timely, I think, that we're talking right now. We're recording this on April 15th. We are less than 1 week out, supposedly, from the halving. So I want to focus a little bit on that as sort of a catalyst for this talk. But maybe even before we get into that, can we just do a little bit of a retrospective for the first 4 months of this year in terms of what's been going on with Bitcoin and specifically focusing on the Bitcoin ETF flows? So it's obviously been a very strong start to the year for Bitcoin and crypto writ large. Obviously, we suffered a little bit of a pullback due to the geopolitical instability that happened over this weekend. But, you know, we'd just love to sort of get your thoughts on, you know, where we are. I think we're sitting at about $12 billion of AUM across this entire suite of Bitcoin ETFs. And we've seen very steady inflows, albeit maybe a little bit stronger in March than in April thus far. But what's your sort of retrospective on the year for Bitcoin so far?
Yeah, so the first 4 months of the year have been certainly interesting, as you said. We got the approval in early January. Big hot start out of the gate. I think everyone was kind of expecting that, myself included. A lot of trading volume, a lot of turnover, a lot of flows. And of course, it was just hard to see what was the true demand or inflows coming in with outflows from the existing product that converted and some of the other noise going on. What I did not expect, and I don't think a lot of people did, especially so soon, was the amount of flows that we got after that. After the initial hot start, the flows came back with a huge wave. And I personally got this wrong. I'm very happy that I got this wrong, but I thought this was going to be kind of a slow burn. If you think about these products, they have to be vetted with all these different RIA firms. They have to go through compliance things. They weren't even on a lot of platforms. Clients have to get comfortable with them, understand them, make an allocation. And I really thought this would just be a slow roll or a steady demand, 6, 12, 18 months or longer out there. And I think you still will get that, but I was just surprised at how much we got so quickly. So we got the classic buy the rumor, sell the news with the approval of the ETFs. And then we went down, I think, close to 20%. And so everyone thought, haha, see, exactly as we thought. But you really saw that was short-term speculation. You saw that in the data. You saw things like the futures positioning, open interest, annualized funding on the perpetual futures got as high as 30%. And that all just came back in with the drop. And so those were really the speculators that were just making the speculation on the approval, classic buy the rumor, sell the news. And then again, everyone was surprised by the amount of inflows that came after. And so how I'm looking at it now, though, is interesting because I can't quite tell, and I don't think anyone can, who's really buying these. Is it the people like the RIAs who are making a core position and they were just waiting for this to get approved and they're going to be holding this for the long term? Or is it more momentum traders, speculators who now have a way to easily express or get exposure to it with an ETF? I'm not sure yet. I think the volumes that we saw were so high that there's got to be a lot of speculation in that. But I do think the bigger story long term is still this wave of consistent demand, consistent inflow that's going to go over the next 12 plus months. So that's kind of how I'm looking at the ETP, ETF landscape right now. But of course, time will tell.
Yeah, no, it's a really good point. There's been a lot of healthy debate I've seen. Are these short-term speculators, more long-term investors? I'm also in the camp that probably short-term, there was definitely some hot money, hedge fund type money coming in, but it's the structurally, it's more like passive structural bid that's going to carry us on from here. Chris, I'd love to get your opinion on the halving. So the halving is this event where the supply schedule of BTC gets cut in half every 4 years. So the block rewards, I actually forget what it's going down to, but it's half of what it historically was. And the Bitcoin halving has acted as this sort of fulcrum around which these crypto four-year cycles swing, right? So typically the price appreciation, actually one thing that's been a little bit different about this cycle is that you saw pretty rapid price appreciation before the halving, which is not typically what happens. Typically it's something like 9 months after the halving. So, you know, this time there's been a little bit of speculation, maybe because of the Bitcoin ETFs, because they just are such a massive catalyst for Bitcoin that the halving is going to be less important. Maybe it's less about the supply, but more of a psychological thing. How are you and the folks at Fidelity Digital viewing the halving these days?
Well, you really hit on all the questions we have as well. So we don't have the answers to all these things. But I can give you some of our thought process. And it's similar to what you laid out here, similar thought process of looking at this. My background's in traditional finance, and I was always taught never to say the four most dangerous words in finance. This time is different. But as you correctly pointed out, we do have a factual thing that is different this time. It is true that we have a new all-time high right before the halving. That has never happened. Of course, the big debate is, well, is that the market pricing this in? Or is that, and therefore, it's not going to be a big of a deal after the halving as it was in the past. So remember, in the past, we've got huge price appreciations 6, 9, 12 months after the halving. Or on the other hand, is this even a more bullish sign that people are getting bullish before the halving and then it's just a signal of what's to come? Obviously, I don't know the answer to that, but I do think one thing to think about is people are more aware of the halving this time. If you look at Google search trends, the last halving 4 years ago, it spiked up the week of and came directly back down. So a lot of news coverage when the halving happened and got a lot of press. This time, you're seeing it go up, and it's going up even a month before or more, and then it's continuing to go up. So people are more aware of it earlier, and I think there's a broader base of people who are aware of it as well. And so I think there's kind of a reflexivity here. As more people become aware of the halving and what it did in the past, that might induce them to buy it, driving up the price. And then the price gets driven up. More people start looking at Bitcoin. Hey, it's at a new all-time high. It's not dead yet. I'm going to look into it. Oh, and then they, as soon as they look into it, what's one of the first things that comes up? Oh, the halving is only a few weeks away. And then that maybe induces them to buy as well. So I think there could be kind of a reflexivity going on here. Now, that said, of course, we could have a crash right before the halving, which we've had in the past. We could have a crash right after it, which we've had in the past. So none of this is predictive. It's just something that I think is different this time around. And of course, we have what we just were talking about, the exchange-traded products. So that's different this time around. Now, whether or not that's linked, I think obviously in some way that's linked to the new all-time highs. So maybe that's already kind of factored in there. But I think that's going to be a big change going forward as well. I'm personally in the camp that it's not fully priced in. You can't fully price it in. You mentioned the reward, it's going from 6.25 approximately every 10 minutes with every block to 3.125. So that's 900 coins per day being minted, getting cut in half to only 450. So the people who say it's not as big of a deal, they say it's a lower amount. Like the amount that gets cut gets smaller and smaller, and we're on a bigger base. So on the supply side, they say not that big of a deal. On the other hand, I think it was someone like Lynn Alden or someone who tweeted, it's like a whale coming in though and buying an extra 450 coins every single day indiscriminate of price. To me, Bitcoin is simply at its base supply and demand like any other asset. That has to have an effect. You're cutting that inflow, that supply in half. And so you need half as less capital to come in, if you will, to replace that. So to me, I still think it is a big deal. I don't know how big, obviously we can debate that, but I don't think it's a nothing burger. And then the final point, and you got at this as well, the halving has gone along with these four-year cycles, but the problem is we don't know if it's the supply side, the halving driving these price gains, or if it's the demand or liquidity side driving it. And so every 4 years we've had an election. These halvings have also coincided with liquidity cycles, which it may do again. So we don't have a counterfactual yet to compare these against. We can't distinguish which one is driving which, or if one was driving it more than the other in the past. So I think this time will be interesting as well. Unfortunately, we might get another surge in liquidity, or we've got another presidential cycle coming up here as well. So we might not get another counterfactual, and we're going to be left to decide, to think about over the next 4 years, well, which one is it? Is it the halving, or is it the demand or liquidity side?
Yeah, there's a great There's a great post actually from the Financial Times a couple of months ago where it shows these sort of very neat 4-year liquidity cycles. And I was looking at it wasn't even the point of the article, but I was just looking at it through my Bitcoin eyes and saying, huh, these are really corresponding pretty closely to the having crypto cycles as well. So the liquidity thing's super interesting. I think maybe, I mean, you were alluding to this before, but one, it's always dangerous to say this time is different, but I do think that one other thing that seems small, but maybe isn't that small, is that what you didn't have during the last halving was the Fidelities of the world. Well, maybe Fidelity was doing this actually, but I just see all these notes from Goldman, JP Morgan, you know, talking to their clients about the halving. And I think there's a very logical, almost mechanical reason why price tends to appreciate post-halving. And it's what you're saying, it's supply and demand. So miners mine the Bitcoin, and then in order to cover their production costs, they ultimately end up selling a bunch of that Bitcoin back out into the market. And so if miners have less Bitcoin, then there's less sell pressure that's going on. And therefore, that equilibrium, you know, gets adjusted so that the Bitcoin price goes a little bit higher. But then there's also this psychological component where after, you know, 5 cycles of this, people start to say, well, I know a little thing about how Bitcoin tends to behave. And it's this sort of psychological, reflexive, self-reinforcing sort of loop. And I like, if I had to editorialize my own opinion here a bit, I think I agree with you. I just think it's not a nothing burger. Maybe the response is slightly diminished over time as the mechanical part of the price appreciation is less and less, but ultimately the psychological impact is still there and it's going to be relevant for some time. I don't know if you have any response to that.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And the ETPs are going to be interesting, not only from a demand perspective, but whether they actually increase volatility. And what I mean by that is, if you've got so many people now who can just access it through the brokerage, who can buy and sell during regular trading hours, and they're being influenced by all this stuff on the news, and they're seeing this, and they're trying to play it, they're not yet in the camp of I want to hold a core portion. They're just seeing it as a momentum trade, something that's moving, something that's in the news, something to play. And I do think personally we have kind of this different psychology post-COVID of financial momentum and games, if you will, ever since like the meme stocks and all that sort of thing. Will that create actually more volatility around this? And I think in the short term, it could. And in the long term, maybe it doesn't, because then you're going to flush those people out and you're going to get more of the long-term holders. And you're going to get financial products built on top of this, the derivatives and all of that, which can dampen volatility. But in the short term, I wouldn't be surprised if these things actually give us more volatility, because people now have the ability to trade in and out so quickly and easily. And you've got a larger market that can do it. Before, you had to go create an account somewhere else. Now it's open to everybody who's got control over their own brokerage accounts.
Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by Mantra, the security-first, compliance-focused L1, which is onboarding the next wave of financial institutions into Web3. So you guys have heard me talk about Larry Fink talking about tokenization. You've seen the clips on CNBC. You know that Larry and BlackRock are very, very excited about this idea. And the reason for that is they're looking at these trillions of dollars of off-chain real-world assets. They want to digitize those and bring them on-chain, which is going to be a massive opportunity. But in order to do that, they need a compliant L1, and that's where Mantra comes in. Mantra's been steadily climbing the ranks and now stands among the top 4 RWA projects on CoinGecko, which is representative of its rapid growth and influence in the tokenization space. Mantra's built using the Cosmos SDK, so they have some very cool stuff out of the box. They've got IBC interoperability. They also leverage CosmWasm smart contracts. Very cool design from an architectural standpoint. The next phase on the blockchain's testnet is Hongbai, so that's launching soon. So if you're a dApp developer or something like that, there's a lot of very cool opportunities for you. And I highly recommend that you click the link at the bottom of the show notes. I don't know that I sent you. Thanks very much again, Mantra, for making this possible. And again, guys, click the link at the bottom of the show notes. So speaking of retail, I was reading a tweet thread that you put out. I guess you just went to the Bitcoin investor event hosted by Anthony Pompliano in New York, which seemed like it had a stellar lineup, and you tweeted out a list of your takeaways. And you differentiated when it came to retail, the crypto native retail, which are maybe more interested in trading some of these meme coins. And then you also distinguish that between brokerage retail. And you said crypto retail has been here for a little while, but it feels like brokerage retail is maybe just starting to come back. So I would love to sort of get your perspective on that. You know, how do you define sort of brokerage retail? I'm not sure how many insights you have onto the brokerage side of the house on Fidelity, but you know, what data were you looking at to kind of support that idea?
This was a comment from someone on the panel, and I don't remember who off the top of my head. I have to go back to my notes, but I just thought it was interesting, which is why I jotted it down and tweeted it later, that people say retail, but if you think of Bitcoin and crypto, there's really two different retails. There was the retail side where they opened accounts at these crypto native firms and brokerages where that's all they did was buy and sell these digital assets. They're retail in terms of their size. They're not institutional investors. They don't manage other people's money. They don't manage large pools of capital. So they manage it for themselves, usually individual. That's that kind of retail, retail crypto native. And then I thought it was interesting that they differentiated that between retail, like the normal brokerage retail. So the Fidelities of the world, all of the other names that you could name. That's kind of a different class. Like they didn't go and open a separate account when they couldn't get it through the regular brokerage. But now that it's available through the regular brokerage, now that's an option to them. And so that opens up a whole new addressable market. And that's why I think I tweeted that and wrote that down, that I think people are underappreciating the size of that market and what could come, because they think retail front ran or came ahead of institutions, which is true and very unique in this marketplace. But I don't think they see the mass affluent, the larger market of retail brokerage that could still come. And Fidelity, of course, we launched our crypto for retail long ago. And obviously, we've seen a lot of interest and activity there. But I think it's just going to get even bigger with more of these players coming into the space and with just obviously the exchange traded products now available to them.
Yeah, it really resonates. I have two, you should never go off anecdotes, right? But I've got two anecdotes to share on this, which is we hosted our institutionally focused conference, Digital Asset Summit in London back in about a month ago in March. And I was moderating a panel, and one of the panelists said, all right, folks, and there were, you know, about 600 people in this room, and said, okay, put your hands up if you bought one of the new Bitcoin ETFs. And there were in this room probably 5 or 10 people that raised their hand. And then they said, okay, now put your hands up if you own crypto. And like the whole room's hand shot up. So what that tells me is that the people that have been here for a little while who already bought their crypto, they're holding their crypto. But basically, I'm going to make the assumption that it's mostly new entrants who are buying the Bitcoin ETFs because they've only been around for a couple months. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And then, you know, I went to a wedding this weekend, and you know, usually I end up talking to just like one or two people, like old friends or something like that. They're like, hey, what's going on with crypto? But last time when we were going through a bull phase, people were asking me, what new coin should I get? What's the next thing? Okay, like what's the next Ether? Those types of questions. But that's not what people were asking me this time. It was, hey, is now a good time to sell? Do you think? I've been holding this Bitcoin for a little bit. And it's just, it just feels a little bit different. And I would also agree with whoever said that on the panel, that it just doesn't really feel like brokerage retail is totally back to the market yet.
Yeah, that's interesting. You're also seeing that anecdote in the data of should I sell now, where on-chain you can see the long-term holders. This is also different this time, reached the highest level. So if you can take different timeframes, of course, but if you just say 1 year or more, people who have held coins on an address for 1 year or longer, that reached an all-time high early this year or late last year of 70%. It'd never been that high. And we kept watching this metric as the price ran up. The price of Bitcoin went up 155% in 2013 alone, and that metric kept going up. So 155% rally was not enough to make these long-term holders move their coins or sell them. Now, with the rally at the beginning of this year, we are starting to see that come back down a little. But this is also something you can view cyclically, where the long-term holders sell into the strength, into the rally, especially as it continues into its kind of blow-off top. And you see the old coins move into the new hands, and then kind of that exchange. And so if you're talking to people who have held for a long time, it makes sense that they're starting to look at, well, do I want to take some off the table, versus people who are just getting into the space. That's who we're seeing currently driving a lot of the volume as well.
Chris, I've got a question for you. Just changing tacks here a little bit. I was thinking about this on my flight home yesterday, which I was kind of unplugged for this weekend. So I only really skimmed the headlines about the pretty spooky attack from Iran on Israel, which thankfully it looks like with the help of the United States were able to largely mitigate the negative impacts there. But markets got pretty spooked. You know, the entire crypto market sold off something like 10%. And, you know, this is around the time where you start to see pundits come out and say, well, you know, how can Bitcoin be a store of value type thing if it's selling off in the face of these geopolitical woes or worries? And I would just be curious how you react to those sorts of things. And, you know, when you're even, you know, speaking to your institutional investor base, like, what is the narrative that really is hitting with people these days on the Bitcoin side? Is it, you know, geopolitical hedge was always maybe a pretty questionable one or a smaller part of that, but is it still kind of the digital gold thing, pristine collateral? Like, A, how do you just maybe given, you know, everything that happened this weekend, like, how do you react when people say, oh, why is Bitcoin a store of value if it's selling off? And then maybe we can transition a little bit into sort of the narrative and some of the conversations that you're having with the more institutional side of the market these days.
On the first or the latter part of that, of the why is it or how can it be a store of value if it's selling off? This is the difference between store of value over the long term versus short term. And so if you're wanting to store value, it's always over a long time frame, almost always at least, right? You want to put your wealth, your energy, your time into something that's not going to degrade. So something that is volatile isn't necessarily a bad store of value. And we wrote a piece almost a year or two ago by now, but it's been cited and said by other people as well, maybe more eloquently than me, but volatility does not equal store of value. It technically has kind of nothing to do with that. And so the extreme example is you could have dollars or other fiat currencies, but let's just say the US dollar, that is not volatile at all. It's going to not change much day to day. But over even just 5 years, we've seen consumer prices go up on average 25%. So you lost a quarter of your purchasing power, but it did so in a somewhat orderly, non-volatile way. But that's not much comfort to you, right? You wanted to store your value for at least 5 years, probably a lot longer if you're saving for something like retirement or if you're a pension or endowment that's saving for an indefinite period, hundreds of years. That's little comfort, right? So volatility is not should not be confused with the ability to store value over the long term. And to me, that's still the core base case of Bitcoin as an asset, as a store of value, not medium of exchange. Medium of exchange to me will likely come later. But right now, as Bitcoin aspires to be this store of value, that's what people should be focusing on, that long term. And so I always think whenever there's a drawdown or even a crash, 80, 90%, go back to the fundamentals. Is the network still operating? Are the blocks still being produced? Is hash rate still largely going up or at least staying stable? So the security of the network is intact. Are people still adopting it, still using it, still transacting on it? Those are all the fundamentals. And again, I used to be an equity analyst. It'd be like looking at the fundamentals of a company. And then if those are still intact, then your investment thesis as store of value still intact? Is the 21 million cap still in play? Is the halving still coming? Those are all the things you should be concerned about as a store of value. And then the day-to-day, week-to-week, even year-to-year volatility doesn't really matter. That's something that comes more on the risk management part of it. And that's what I don't get that even institutional investors should know, getting now to the narrative part of it. A lot of them that say, well, I can't own it because it's too volatile. Well, Bitcoin is less volatile than a lot of stocks. It's been less volatile than Netflix. Many institutional investors own Netflix. And that's just one example. I'm not citing Netflix for any reason, just as a hypothetical. We've even ran some numbers where at one point late last year, Bitcoin's 1 year volatility got down to 30% on an annualized basis. And there were 60 to 90 stocks somewhere in there in the S&P 500 that were more volatile than Bitcoin at that time. So you're talking almost 20% of the S&P 500 was more volatile than Bitcoin, but everyone owns the S&P 500. And so this is where I scold institutional investors a little bit, like you should know better. If it's an issue of volatility, then it's an issue of risk management. It's an issue of position sizing. That's not an issue of the investment thesis of whether or not you should own it. So I think that's the correct way to look at it, or at least for an institutional investor who has a long time frame, or anyone who has a long time frame that wants to store value and then obviously take advantage of Bitcoin's maturing into this store of value. So obviously it's not just storing value, it's actually appreciating because other people are coming to realize this core investment thesis.
Yeah, I think I've heard that so many times over the years that it's just volatile, but I think there's something hidden that's going on alongside that as well, which is part of it really is the volatility, right? Like I do think in general, investors have a preference towards stuff that goes up more steadily and slowly, because that just feels a little bit more natural, you know, or realistic, or sustainable over a long period of time. But then there's also this unsaid element, which is just, I don't really get what this is. And I'm not particularly interested in trying to understand it. And I think oftentimes when you hear people just point to the volatility, what they're really saying is this thing is, and it kind of feeds on each other, right? Because if something, you don't really understand it and it feels a little weird, and then it goes up 200% and then down 80, you're like, hey, you know what? Too hard, right? I'm putting this in my too hard bucket. One other thing I think that really gets people, and this is the same challenge that gold struggles with as well, and frankly, like commodities in general, is that they don't produce cash flows. And there's just an enormous bucket of investors that just won't wrap their heads around that. And I mean, this is why, like, you know, you hear the gold bugs talk about this all the time. They sort of bemoan the low percentage of institutional investors that hold gold. And I really think it comes down to this idea of, you know, Paul Tudor-Jones calls it a barbarous relic, right? It's a greater fools sort of thing. I think that's one of the challenges that really people just struggle to wrap their heads around as well.
Yeah, I was just at a conference and it wasn't a digital asset or Bitcoin conference. And there were a lot of financial advisors and RIAs there. And I heard both of those things that you just said, the I don't get it too hard and the non-cash flow things. And they're somewhat related, yeah, but different. So the non-cash flow one is interesting. I have a good friend who I used to work with on the TradFi side, and he's a really good investor, but he actually gets the macro thesis of Bitcoin being scarce and a potential hedge against inflation and monetary debasement and looking at large fiscal deficits. He's all there. But then when it comes to Bitcoin, he says, it doesn't have a cash flow. I don't get it. I'm better off buying companies that I can analyze and I can get my head around, and I have a competitive edge here. What's my edge with Bitcoin? What do I know that someone else doesn't know? And I don't know if I still have a good answer to this, but I think part of it is, what you know that other people don't know is you can see the path of this monetization of Bitcoin. It'd be like the best analogy or proxy we have is when gold went from fixed at $35 an ounce to freely floating. And people, again, gold doesn't pay a cash flow either, but the people who realize that this is a big deal for gold to be freely floating and it's now legal for U.S. citizens to hold it again, and they were looking at the inflation of the 70s and the large deficits that couldn't be sustained, and they bought it before other people because they saw that you're going to have something that's relatively scarce measured against something that they're creating more of, and they must create more of, which is currency, fiat money. And so I think that's what you see or know, or what your competitive advantage or edge is against other investors with Bitcoin as well. And then the whole doesn't pay a cash flow thing, I get it. You know, I used to be equity analyst. Everything was thrown into a discounted cash flow model. So what do you do with gold and Bitcoin? At the simplest level, you just look at it, total addressable market. And of course, Bitcoin is superior to gold in many ways in terms of its divisibility and fungibility and be able to verify it, all that stuff. So you could assign some percent of taking gold's market cap. So that makes sense on one level. I actually talked to someone who didn't understand the case for Bitcoin. He had it in his too hard pile. I don't get it. It's just code. It's software. But then he turned around in the very next sentence said, but I understand art. I'll own art to store my value rather than Bitcoin. And I thought, what an interesting perspective. But I think it gets to your point that it's something they're comfortable with. This person liked art. They maybe had a little bit of an eye towards what could store value, what might appreciate in value. They knew the market, they knew the prices. But talk about, you know, something that's very subjective, illiquid, hard to monetize. Bitcoin is just so superior in all of those ways, but yet they couldn't make that leap. And so I think that's where we still are today. I don't have a good answer yet to the non-cash flow thing. I think Matt Hogan had an interesting perspective or tweet on this a while ago where he said, it's like getting access to this scarce good and a monetary payment network, But to get exposure, you got to buy into it. You got to buy the token. And I'm maybe getting it wrong, but it was something like that. I thought that was pretty good. The other angle that I've tried is, would you buy undeveloped land? A lot of investors are very familiar with the investment case for undeveloped land. It doesn't pay a cash flow, but you buy it in anticipation of it increasing because it's going to have more utility in the future. If you could buy a piece of undeveloped land in Manhattan hundreds of years ago, you absolutely would. There'd be a very high price you'd pay for that if you had the insight into seeing how the development was going and how much more valuable this land was going to be. That's maybe one other angle. So don't know if I've convinced enough people yet, but it is a tough one for the traditional financial mindset to get their head around.
Hello, listeners of On the Margin. I've got good news for those of you who are in the crypto scene. Blockworks is bringing back Permissionless. We're going to be doing Permissionless 3, and this year we are heading west. So we're moving that out to Salt Lake City. That's going to be October 9th through 11th this year. We've got a phenomenal lineup of speakers for you. So we've got Balaji headlining. We've got Sriram Munib, Matt Hogan of Bitwise, Jan Van Eck. This one's going to be a blast, guys. And I saw many of you out in London for DAS this year, and I hope to see you out in Salt Lake for Permissionless. And because y'all are such faithful listeners, we've got, if you use code MARGIN10, you're going to get 10% off your tickets. Appreciate you all. Hope to see you out there. So I think you can look out into the world and see there are different investors who've been trained in different schools of thought, right? And there are, you know, you have a background in equity, you know, in equities, and people do like to put everything into a discounted cash flow. And it's, you know, the current value is the discounted sum of all future cash flows, that type of thing. But there are other types of investors that trade commodities, that trade currencies. Maybe they invest in art, wine, gold. And for them, fundamentals actually is just exactly what you're describing, supply and demand imbalance. And they're actually much more comfortable not backing into some idea of fundamental value, right? Intrinsic value, which is this sort of esoteric idea that especially equity investors are obsessed with. And they just say it's really a function of supply and demand. And I think anecdotally, you know, you could see a lot of the early adopters of Bitcoin actually came from these backgrounds of like commodities, prop shop, currency trading, because they didn't really care that much about what the thing is. They just saw that it was liquid and people wanted it, and supply and demand was going to make price go up, and they had a bullish thesis on that. And that, I think that explains why there's a lot of like CTAs that got into Bitcoin early. A lot of the especially high frequency trader, more market making type funds, the, you know, Jane Streets and the Susquehannas of the world, they just kind of stepped right in because they just understood that this was something that people wanted. They weren't hung up on this idea of cash flow. And maybe ultimately the way that it'll shake out with crypto is roughly the same amount of investors out there that are really need to be able to back into some sort of fundamental valuation. You know, that'll be how Bitcoin shakes out. But I wanted to bring this up actually in the context of Ethereum as well, because I know you guys put out a report back in, I think, late 2023, where you're describing sort of the investment case for Ethereum, and you focused on it being maybe a little bit less of a money, but more of a technology platform, and especially yield being a really critical narrative. So I would love to just get your sense of the sort of institutional demand, and like, what is the narrative? Like, what really catches people about the investment case for Ether side of things? And then we can back into some of those more specific arguments that you were talking about.
For institutional investors, the thesis can be different, just like Bitcoin. But I do think one that makes sense for Ethereum is more of the utility argument. So a little bit more like a commodity like oil rather than gold. If Bitcoin's gold and Ether's oil, this is a classic analogy. But I think it does hold up, because just like oil can go through huge swings depending on, again, basic supply and demand, we've seen Ether go through these big swings based on supply and demand. And of course, the key difference with Ether is you need it to transact on the network, to do things on the network. You got to pay that gas fee, right? But I do think, and this is just me a little more personally talking, that I don't see the narrative of Ether as being money. And people really tried to push this with the ultrasound money when they went through the merge. And then we started getting deflationary forces on Ether, with more Ether being burned than issued. So we've had, I think, 450,000 Ether or more now burned, yet the price has gone down in terms of Bitcoin. So that's, I think, how you have to look at it. Ether priced in Bitcoin. And that's continued to trend down, or at least kind of stagnate. And you see a little spike every now and then. For example, with the recent upgrade, there was a little bit of a rally there. We've come back down from that already. So I think the narrative of money is it's not that it's completely dead. Like, if some people want to view it as money, well, that's going to be their prerogative, and it's going back to subjective value. I think everything in terms of value is subjective, but I just think once you compare it to Bitcoin, why would you choose that as your long-term store value when Bitcoin has it's more decentralized, it's more secure, and to me, you're more comfortable in the issuance schedule not changing, and that's the key, right? It's not that Ether's issuance schedule is now deflationary at times that makes it better. The ultimate measure of soundness of money is how sure of you of it not changing. And it's changed in the past and it might change again in the future. But I do think what the narrative that does make sense is having this platform that all of these things are built on top of. And this gets a little bit to our research report, where as more and more people join the network, transact on it, get things done that they want to get done that have utility to them, and they build these applications on top of it, that eventually has to flow through and accrue to the token holder. And so that's the key thing. Like, why would I hold Ether for the long term, just holding it and expect it to appreciate in value? And the thesis there is that the value will trickle down as more and more stuff gets built on top of it. The problem is Ether or Ethereum has a lot more competition. So you've got on one end, the Solanas of the world, faster, cheaper, but they're less decentralized. I think the market's trying to figure out if they really value decentralization or how much they value it. And so I think Ethereum going forward, and this is a little more just my personal opinion, it's a bit of a no man's land where it's got to find that narrative. If it's not the sound money, is it the ultimate computing platform that everything gets built on top of? But it's got to capture the market where people still want more of a decentralized network versus something that's faster and cheaper like the Solanas of the world. And so I think they're still trying to figure that out this year. And we'll see how that evolves with the latest upgrade, with blobs now making cheaper transactions and all of that.
Mm. Yeah, that was so I think what you just said about the predictability and non-changingness is so important. So listeners, go back and re-listen to that, because I've also never been a fan of the ultrasound money narrative because of exactly what you just described. Because to me, the Bitcoin superpower is its simplicity. And I see in a lot of your like tweets and writings, like you really go back to this used to be a much bigger debate, like simplicity versus complexity in blockchain architecture. And that's what Bitcoin has always been optimizing for. Super simple design, non-changing, extremely predictable. And I would be in the camp, Bitcoin is still inflationary. Bitcoin has been pretty consistently more inflationary than ETH post 1559. But the thing is that it's super, super predictable. And to your point, its monetary policy hasn't changed. Whereas right now, a huge debate in Ethereum is actually, messing with their issuance policy and changing it. And so I do think though, in the long run, that you do need to probably do need to have some amount of changing of monetary policy. Like at some point, I do think, like maybe no change is not the right approach either. But I do think that's a massive advantage of Bitcoin, that it's just super predictable, very transparent. And even if it's more net deflationary, but more confusing, you've already lost people. And it does feel a little bit like, to me, Ethereum is maybe in between narratives at the current moment. But you wrote about if I were unilaterally in charge of Ethereum, and I say this and literally nobody likes this perspective, but I'd be leaning into yield. Because Ethereum is in this very interesting place where it's kind of in this Bitcoin Ethereum class of their own, right? Those are kind of clearly the two leaders, maybe just in terms of market cap, liquidity, all that type of stuff. But Ethereum can do this thing that Bitcoin can't do, which is produce yield. And as we were just discussing, that is a massive hang up for global investors. And just look at the size of like the bond market versus the stock market, right? For an example there. So I don't know. How do you view this idea of yield? Do you think that makes it an easier story to sell to investors? Like how important or helpful is that on the institutional stage?
It's hugely important on the institutional stage because, as you said, they get it. It's immediate light bulb on. Oh, this pays a yield. Yeah. Oh, so it's like a interest payment for a bond, or it's like a dividend for a stock. I can model that. And that's what we did in the report too. We did a simple discounted cash flow model just to show the framework. Obviously, we're not putting any emphasis or stock in the actual numbers. It's more just an illustration to show what's embedded in that, or what you would have to assume to get today's current price. And then you can start making your guesses or your probabilistic kind of scenarios on what you think happens. Does activity go up? Do we get more fees? Do more people stake? Does the yield go higher or lower? And you can start playing with all those variables. So it's a lot easier for people to understand than going back to our previous conversation on Bitcoin pays no cash flow. How do I value that? This sort of thing. So it's definitely a big one. One thing, though, we do point out is it's not necessarily a good or bad thing, these two different consensus mechanisms, proof of work versus proof of stake, where the yield comes from. But it does depend on what you're trying to accomplish. So there is one report we put out called Understanding Proof of Work. And it's a very non-technical guide to understanding the proof of work consensus mechanism, what's actually going on. We make a point that it should be cherished for Bitcoin because it is the key linchpin that makes it, in our mind, an aspiring form of money. But then we compare it to proof of stake, and we're pretty careful to say it's not universally this one's better or worse. It depends on what you want to do. And I always give the analogy of what's the best vehicle? Well, nobody can answer that unless you know what you're trying to accomplish. What's your mission? Maybe if you're commuting to work every day, you drive on good highways, you want an efficient sedan. If you live in the outback, you might need a four-wheel drive pickup truck to literally survive or carry on your farm work or whatever it is. And so you have to match the mission or the objective to what you're trying to do, and then be intellectually honest in evaluating those trade-offs. And so that's what we try to do with the report and what we try to do with investors as well. You're getting a yield here. But there are good things about that, bad things about that, trade-offs. You have to understand where that yield comes from, what could change that yield, where there could be risk for that, all of those factors that come into play.
Yeah. And, well, Chris, what would you say to this? Because this is always a little bit dangerous to, I sort of am in the camp that blockchains and crypto assets are something totally new. So I feel like, I try to provide analogies to commodities or stocks or bonds, but I'm sort of in the camp that it's somewhat new, and you can start to, reasoning by analogy, you might jam yourself into some boxes that don't necessarily make sense. But I also do think that, when it comes to something like Ethereum and like staked Ethereum, that's a pretty good analogy for something like treasuries. And, even the line in between, like what is a money, it does get a little bit fuzzy and gray, right? Like, are treasuries a money? No, not really, but corporations hold them on their balance sheet and get to mark them as money. And, there's a monetary like premiums in assets like real estate or oil or something like that. And, going back to your point about did cash hold its value for the last 5 years, I guess not these last 5 years in particular, but, all those charts that everyone shows of, the US dollar losing 90% of its value, not if you stake those dollars, right? Not if you were holding treasuries and yield bearing money, right? You accomplish basically the same thing as gold, and you actually outperform gold slightly. So I guess what would you say to that? That maybe, Ether could be sort of this staked dollar bond like thing that holds its value similarly to Bitcoin, just in a different way by producing a form of yield instead of the sort of ultrasound supply schedule.
Yeah. One thing that's really been helpful in my thinking is on the research team, we do a book, kind of a book club where we read through a book every so often. And a number of months ago, years ago, we read Layered Money. And so that book goes through how money has evolved and changed, and also how layers have been built on top of the monetary system, and then how in times of history, those upper layers collapse, and then they collapse down to that ultimate base. And so, of course, for thousands of years, that ultimate base was gold. And if you think about money, you think about the properties that make good money: divisible, verifiable, scarce, so it holds its purchasing power. You can send it, you can do all those things. And so that's why gold came out on top. And then there were layers on top of it. So you think of the US dollar, it was redeemable for gold, right? So the dollar was, some people distinguish this saying a currency versus a money. Sometimes that's helpful, I think, where the currency is just something you use to transact in or keep a unit of count, but ultimately its value is being tied to something underneath it or redeemable for it. And we saw how those layers give you more options. It's obviously, there's a reason why we had paper US dollars tied to gold. It was much easier to send these pieces of paper around the world through time and space than it is gold, right? And so it makes sense why you have the layers, but then there's a trade-off. If someone who's controlling that layer or that ledger expands it too much, or they break their trust in that redeemability. And now all of a sudden gold is, or the dollar is not redeemable for gold, that breaks down. And so I think we'll get layers. We're going to get layers, and those layers might be other things like Ether, and they might be used for certain applications or things like that. But ultimately, where does it get its value from is the question people need to answer. Personally, I think that Bitcoin is currently, in terms of just look at the data, the dominance in terms of value. But even if other things get built on it and that the dominance goes down, Bitcoin's value is still going to go up because people are still going to come back to this ultimate bearer instrument that is the most secure, the most decentralized. And so you could have other layers on top of it. The question is, will they survive? Will they come and go? My personal opinion is looking at history and books like this is we're going to get layers. We're going to get layers on Bitcoin. That was one of the things we talked about in our 2024 look ahead report. We're seeing kind of a Bitcoin renaissance, these L2s built on Bitcoin. I think that's what comes and goes, but Bitcoin remains the base layer. I've heard people talk about this as like your foundation, right? Because of all those properties. So that's my personal opinion, how that could evolve. We'll see if other things start to eclipse that or not. But ultimately, I think people will want something to tie everything back to.
Mm. Yeah, it's funny. We do our conference that we do with Bankless Permissionless this year, Bitcoin Renaissance, exactly that is one of the big themes. So very much, even call it the same thing. So on a similar wavelength there. You know, Chris, maybe we could start to wind down here. I'd love to just get your thoughts on kind of the macro overview in here. And, you know, if I could get you to dust off your crystal ball for the end of this year. You know, I think something that's on people's minds, obviously geopolitical risk and uncertainty is never good for markets, but it also looks like we kind of got our third straight month of hotter than expected inflation prints. And this is pushing people's expectation of rate cuts out, certainly to July, but you've got guys like Larry Summers who are questioning whether we should even be doing any rate cuts this year. And in fact, if we should be looking at a rate hike, putting that back on the table if inflation is heating back up. So, you know, I don't know if you have any specific thoughts on inflation or just when you look out into the world of markets, you know, what are you kind of seeing and thinking?
One of the things we talked about in our 2024 look ahead report is this idea that Bitcoin was, the narrative for a while was growth stocks on steroids. And you got that from the correlation, depending on the time frame you looked at, like 3 months or something shorter, it got up to like 0.8, 0.9 correlation, almost perfectly correlated to S&P 500 or even more so the NASDAQ, right? And so people were treating this like a high beta growth stock sort of thing. The question was, is that the new normal or are we going to go back to where over the long term, Bitcoin has not been correlated to really anything, real estate, commodities, stocks, bonds, even gold. And we're seeing that correlation break down and come back in again. And I think that's where we thought we'd be because I would say in the short term, people can treat Bitcoin like however they want it. I can pound the table all day and say, Bitcoin's not a tech stock. It's fundamentally different. It doesn't share any of these same things. But if traders are going to trade it like that, you know, going back to like your comments about CTAs and stuff, if they see something moving, they're just going to trade it and throw it in a bucket with everything else. That's how it's going to trade. But thankfully, we're seeing that correlation kind of come back in. And I think people are realizing that it's not a tech stock. So what is it? Is it going to look like or what kind of analogy they're going to make? And as just a funny aside, you talked about the problem of putting it into one bucket. It never quite works. I always love the, I don't know if you ever read that Spencer Bogart article, I think it was back in 2017, what does Bitcoin and the platypus have in common?
Oh, I didn't, but I could guess.
It's a great article. I encourage anyone to look it up. It really opened my eyes as I went on my early journey. And the answer is they're both category creators. And so he goes through the history of the platypus when European naturalists found it in Australia in 1790. And they sent a drawing back to their counterparts in Europe, and they thought it was a hoax, a fake. They said, there's no way this animal exists. It's got bill of a duck. It's got fur like a mammal. It's got a venomous spur on its back leg, or at least the male does, and it lays eggs. So what category does it fit in? They sent a pelt back to them and they still didn't believe them. They thought it was the work of some skilled taxidermist that had sewn different parts of an animal together. So awesome. It is always dangerous to try to put Bitcoin into a category. It's a category creator, in my opinion. And it's always dangerous to try to say what's the narrative. But I do think one of the things we put in our report, our 2024 look ahead report, was do we see Bitcoin as gold on steroids? And the reason we looked at this was one of the charts we have is the real rate, so nominal rates, less inflation, charted against Bitcoin. And you have to make one of them inverted. So we made real rates inverted so you could see how they followed each other more closely. But this all made sense early on when real rates went lower, lower, and lower, and then even negative as the Fed went to zero and inflation was still positive. You had negative real rates. Bitcoin did good. Okay, and that makes sense. You and I know Bitcoin's not just Bitcoin. It's always relative. Institutional investors are always looking at capital allocation. Do I put my money here or there? So with negative real rates, Bitcoin looks a lot more attractive because if I hold a bond to maturity and someone has to hold a bond to maturity, you're going to get a negative real return. You are guaranteed a negative real return. Okay, I'd rather not have that locked in and hold that to maturity. I'll take a chance with a little bit of Bitcoin. So it did well. And then the Fed raised rates at one of the fastest paces on record, of course, and rates got positive. Inflation went down. So real rates got even more positive. And Bitcoin did poorly. Again, makes sense. Relative thinking. I can get a nice juicy yield here. 2013, Fed stays higher for longer. Real rates are high. Bitcoin doesn't keep going down. It doesn't even go sideways. It rallies 155%. Now, some people say, well, that's just a lot of Bitcoin doing its own thing. They were speculating on the approval of the ETPs. Maybe. I was in the camp that something else is going on here on the macro front. And I think gold, I think that because gold was doing the same thing. Gold looked very similar to Bitcoin, not on the same magnitude, but the same shape. And so I think gold and Bitcoin were starting to sniff something else out. And I think they're either sniffing out, at the time it looked like we'd have more rate cuts, or they're looking at all these structural fiscal imbalances that are not going to be fixed anytime soon. At least that's what the math suggests. And this is going on when we're in a relative peacetime history with no recession. So what happens if we get either one of those two things? And so now you see gold hitting a new all-time high and Bitcoin rallying as well. And so I think it still is responding to these inflation expectations. As you said, we'd had a few, I think three hot CPI reports in a row now. And so the other thing we can look at, and we do this on the research side, is Bitcoin versus inflation expectations. And so, of course, Bitcoin's always forward-looking like any other market. And we saw with the last huge run-up in inflation expectations, Bitcoin followed that as well. Now, it didn't follow the lag of inflation actually getting higher later, but that's because it was more forward-looking, or at least in my opinion. So if I look at the macro front today, that's kind of what I'm watching. And I think back to the 70s, I wasn't alive, but studied it. And one thing is interesting that, especially for people who weren't alive, you just kind of say, oh, the high inflation of the 70s. Like it was just one homogenous decade of just high inflation. But it was actually two very distinct waves. There was a huge wave up in inflation, came back down, thought they had it beat, and they got another wave up again. Not saying that's going to happen here, but I think we have to consider that as a possibility that with these hot prints, maybe inflation is a lot stickier than we thought. Maybe it's going to come back. And so Bitcoin could be sniffing some of that out as well. So those are some of the things we're looking at. We also find Bitcoin very highly correlated to monetary conditions, changes in liquidity. If you plot things like M2, year-over-year growth for the whole world in US dollars, very, very high correlation. So that's the other thing we're watching here as we get into the middle of the year.
Do you know where we are, Chris, in this sort of global liquidity cycle right now? Like I know there was a big contraction in M2 in 2022, and now it's rebounding a little bit. But what is the sort of prognosis for liquidity in the next, year or so?
Yeah, it's ticking up a little. You're seeing a few countries cut rates. Was it? I can't remember who it was. If it was Australia. We're seeing over this last weekend the dollar yen breaking out over 150 again. So I think it's liquidity's back in the focus here. It'll just be interesting to see what they do if inflation stays sticky or higher for longer. On the macro side, you hear more talk of a new goal, moving that goalpost from 2% up a little bit. That makes sense to me. I'm not making a normative statement of whether that's good or bad. I'm just saying it makes sense in terms of the playbook because we've seen this pattern before. It used to be price stability was inflation around zero or positive. And then it was, 0 to 1%, 0 to 2%. Now it's a 2% target, not 0 to 2%, but we want at least 2% or average around there. So I wouldn't be surprised if they start moving that up as well, which again, would probably be positive for Bitcoin and other digital assets.
It would appear at least that the four-year cycle for crypto is still roughly held here. And we're in one of these bull market sort of upswings. You know, people always want to make a baseball analogy, right? Like, what inning are we in? But you know, if you had to make a prognosis, you know, in terms of how far you think we are into this cycle, you know, whereabouts are we from your perspective, and how much more legs do we sort of have ahead of us?
We do a quarterly signals report for free on our website. The next one should be coming out next week. I think Monday. So I don't want to front run it too much, but I'll give a little sneak preview here in that what we do in our signals report is we take all these on-chain metrics, indicators, and people have heard of these, especially in the institutional world, that they hear like, oh, there's all these new indicators. You have all this visibility on-chain, which is amazing, but they don't know how to interpret them or which ones to look at or how to view them. So what we did was we took the ones that we think are higher signal, and we're currently going through some more statistical analysis, making it more rigorous to really analyze which ones are. But we've got the ones we think are pretty relevant, and then we put them into time frames, buckets, and that's the key. You got to look at the right signal for the right time frame. So short term to us is less than a year. Not surprisingly, that's mostly just momentum, RSI, moving averages. Supply and demand, Bitcoin moves on these things. That makes sense to us. It's very much a momentum asset that it moves up and then it moves down a lot in these momentum waves. Medium term to us is that four-year cycle. So our rating, positive, negative, neutral, is really showing, are we at extremes? Are we at a bear market low extreme where Bitcoin looks cheap by many metrics, or does it look very oversold by many metrics on a longer time frame? Or are we looking really expensive at a blow off top? And the sneak peek I'll give here, probably not surprising for people who follow this, is we're well off of those bear market lows, but we're nowhere near the blow off tops that we've seen in the past. So again, past performance not indicative of future, but we're kind of in that middle. And that should make sense after the rally we've seen. The interesting thing, though, is that most of the price appreciation that we've seen in the past happens in the second half of going from the middle to the extreme blow-off tops. And so that's when things get really, really crazy, right? We only had 100, only, I say, it's all relative. In the traditional asset world, 155% rally in 1 year, 2013 would be amazing. And then we're still up, even with the drawdown, we're still up, you know, 40, 50% on Bitcoin this year. But we're getting towards the middle, but the back half can be the really crazy part. And so that's what I'll kind of say in terms of the medium term. And then the long term, we just look at those long-term fundamentals I mentioned before. Is the network growing? Are people still transacting on it? Basically, this is for someone who's maybe sold on the investment thesis, they want a core position, they're DCAing into it, and they just want to make sure that thesis is intact. And that currently is still intact as well for both Bitcoin and Ether.
Awesome. Well, Chris, this has been phenomenal. And, you know, I know you alluded to a little bit of the work that you've put out, but maybe if you just want to give folks who are listening, you know, if they want to find out more about the research that you do or follow you or whatever, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, the best way is our website, fidelitydigitalassets.com. And you can either go /research or just click on the research tab at the top. And then I'm at Chris J. Kiper on Twitter or X.
Awesome. All right, Chris, this has been a ton of fun. Thank you so much for coming on. We'll have to do it again sometime soon.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
All right. Cheers.